Our oral argument, or our oral calendar this morning is State of Minnesota versus Brianna Seamers. You can correct me if I mispronounce the name. Just for your reminder, each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes for appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that time for rebuttal. The timing restriction is indicated in the clock somewhere on your screen, hopefully, depending on how you've set up your view. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument because we keep track of the proceedings only in an audio recording. If the technology gets behind us, if you can't hear or see anyone who's participating, just somehow bring it to our attention and we can pause the proceedings. But so far, technology's worked out okay. Fingers crossed that we'll continue through this proceeding. Counsel for appellant, whenever you are ready to proceed, you have the floor.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Matt Holson, H-O-L-S-O-N, and I represent the appellant, Brianna Seamers. I think both parties essentially are on the same page regarding the legal framework that we're dealing with here. So in this case, Ms. Seamers pled guilty to an amended charge of second-degree manslaughter with the opportunity to argue for both a downward dispositional departure as well as a downward durational departure. The dispositional side of things focuses on the offender. The durational side of things focuses on the offense. Ultimately, at the trial court, Judge Jesse denied both the durational departure and the dispositional departure. I want to start by focusing my argument on the denial of the durational departure. And Judge Jesse's express statement in denying that departure essentially was, quoting Judge Jesse, "Somebody died, there was a price to be paid." And that was the focus of his denial of the durational departure. And as the court's well aware, death would be an element of manslaughter in the second degree. So to the extent that that was the basis for Judge Jesse's denial of the durational departure, that would be a basis to deny every single durational departure that would be made on a second degree manslaughter case. And that simply cannot be the circumstance. Otherwise, the motion for the durational departure in that circumstance would be meaningless and ineffectual. So in applying an element of the offense and then failing to draw any sort of comparisons between this particular second degree manslaughter and any other second degree manslaughter, Judge Jesse simply didn't exercise any discretion whatsoever. And it would be then an abuse of discretion on his part pursuant to State v. Hallmark. I think from my perspective, that is a fairly straightforward analysis. I think this court needs to remand the matter back to the trial court to address Judge Jesse's decision not to grant the downward durational departure in this particular circumstance.
That wasn't the only reason for the durational denial, right? There were other reasons the court gave.
Well, I think to the extent that you adopt the state's argument that Judge Jesse essentially conflated the durational and dispositional departure argument, that might be the case. But from my perspective, Judge Jesse's analysis essentially was bifurcated. So he addressed first the motion for the downward dispositional departure, laid out his rationale for denying that particular motion, then moved on to the motion for the durational departure, didn't provide any additional analysis for denying that particular motion other than the reference to the fact that the decedent had died as a result of Ms. Seamers' actions. And as I previously indicated, that would be the case in any second degree manslaughter case that would be coming before Judge Jesse on a motion for a downward durational departure. So in my mind, I think he was very explicit in terms of stating these are the reasons I'm denying the downward durational departure. Those explicit reasons that he stated for denying that motion are against logic because they would be present in any second degree manslaughter case that would appear before the court in a similar circumstance.
But one of the things the district court cited was this wasn't a single isolated incident of a sale, one-time sale to the victim when the victim died. This was a continuing sale. There were multiple times. Are you saying that's not a valid reason for a durational departure, for denying a durational departure?
So, Your Honor, I think the problem here is with respect to Judge Jesse's analysis and the way that he laid that out. So he didn't explicitly lay out saying, I'm going to confine these reasons for denying the dispositional departure. I'm going to confine these reasons for denying the durational departure. But I think what we can do is take Judge Jesse at his word when he explicitly says, here is why I am denying the durational departure. So when he laid out...
Can I ask you about that? I just want to clarify the case law in which you're basing this argument about the inapplicable offense-based characteristics, because your counterpart argues in her brief that you haven't cited a case saying that a court can look at a single element. And I understand there's also one facet of your argument is the comparison to in the heat of passion, first degree manslaughter. So can you clarify for me, because I was just looking at Hallmark, it doesn't look to me like Hallmark deals with sentencing error. And I gather that you cited Hallmark simply for what an abuse of discretion is in the criminal context. Am I right about that?
That's correct, Your Honor. And I know that my counterparts cite State v. Olson for the principle that there was an explicit case law cited in my argument. I think if the court looks at Olson, what the Court of Appeals did in that particular case is it cited elements of that particular offense that distinguished that case from other similar cases. So the majority opinion opinion in that case explicitly indicated the length of an attack and the number of the victims involved are not elements of aiding and abetting harassment with a firearm. And those two factors were then a basis for denying the dispositional departure. I think as a matter of logic, it stands to reason that citing an element as a basis for denying either a durational departure or a dispositional departure, simply as a basis for departure, doesn't make any sense.
Aren't district courts supposed to look at the actual offense conduct for the durational departure aspect and then consider it compared to other similar comparable offenses? And tell me why this is wrong. Isn't one way of reading what the district court said here that, you know, this is actually worse than a first degree heat of passion manslaughter because it wasn't just a one-off. This was something that was done multiple times. Why is that reading wrong? And if it's not wrong, why is it an abuse of discretion?
Well, so Your Honor, I think that the abuse of discretion exists in terms of citing the element of there being a decedent is the basis for denying the durational departure. Because in every single second degree manslaughter case you are going to have, there is going to be a decedent.
I don't want you to miss fully answering Judge Eat's question, but you keep focusing though on this idea that the district court describing the dispositional or addressing the dispositional departure motion and addressing the durational departure motion is somehow the circumstances aren't sometimes transferable one to the other. and if the district court is somehow required to state exactly the formally, now I am considering durational, and these are the only things I'm considering. Or the district court is bound to say, I am also considering the other things I've mentioned. I don't know that we have a case that confines the district court the way you're asking us to confine the district court. I don't want you to miss out. I don't want to distract you from Judge Eads answering Judge Eads' question if you haven't fully answered it, but I'll just tell you, it seems at least a little bit obvious to me that if we were to grant your request and remand it to the district court, simply because the district court didn't discuss the multiple circumstances at the time he was discussing, at the time the court was discussing durational departure, that the district court's not going to come to a different decision.
Well, and Your Honor, we don't know what decision the court's going to make on remand. Ultimately, I don't disagree with you as a matter.
Isn't it clear from what the district court said that the district court did not, from a 30,000 foot view, did not consider this case less serious, substantially, significantly less serious than a typical case because of the multiple occurrences that the district court referenced?
So let me back up to the initial question you asked, Judge Ross. Ultimately, I don't disagree with you that to some extent the analysis can be conflated or combined to some degree. And I think the court, for example, could say, I'm denying the dispositional departure, and for the same reasons, in addition to these other factors, I'm going to deny the durational departure as well. And I think when the court does that, it's fairly clear, particularly in terms of the appellate analysis, what factors the court was relying on in terms of reaching the decision that it reached.
Well, let me ask it slightly different way. Wouldn't you agree that the district court's concern about the multiple incidents would apply only to durational and not dispositional departure?
Your Honor, I think it could be fairly applied to both in terms of evaluating whether Ms. Seamers was amenable to probation. For example, I think in drawing that distinction, evaluating her amenability, evaluating what kind of offender she is, part of that analysis certainly could be, this is somebody that is regularly engaged in the sale of controlled substances. We've got these other factors we look at, and consequently, she is more culpable, less amenable to probation, less amenable to treatment than someone that does this on one particular occasion and makes a singular bad decision. So I certainly think it's the sort of thing that could be used in both facets of the analysis in terms of both
the durational. Even if it was broader than that, though, I'm sorry to interrupt. In Walker, didn't we say that for a dispositional departure, you can consider both offense and offender-based characteristics? I know there's some tension with other decisions, but that's what we said. So you could consider it. You could consider, even if you weren't using it as she regularly engages, as something that's offender-based, but rather in this case, it's part of the case that she sold to the decedent multiple times. And that's offense conduct. You could use that for a dispositional departure, right? I mean, that's what we said.
Correct.
So I guess my question is, for the durational departure, I think to what I understood Judge Ross asking earlier, why is it inappropriate that the district court considered this not just an isolated incident? And I think Judge Schmidt touched on that as well. You know, the district court didn't just say when it imposed the sentence, someone died. The district court said a number of things, including, and you did this more than once. And that's offense conduct, and that's fair game for a durational departure, right?
No, and I don't necessarily disagree with you that it's not fair game. I think it is, I think the question becomes, in terms of this court's decision, how the court evaluates what Judge Jesse said in terms of his basis for denying the durational departure.
And you want us to infer that the district court confined itself in terms of statements that the district court made following the indication that now we're going to talk about dispositional departure. Now we're going to talk about durational departure, that we're to interpret the district court's statements as self-confining.
Your Honor, what I'm suggesting that the court do is take Judge Jesse at his word when he stated the reasons that he was denying the durational departure.
Fair enough, but he didn't say exclusively. He didn't use that.
No, he didn't say exclusively, but he also didn't say, I'm also including the statements that I made earlier when I was addressing the dispositional departure request. So, you know, ultimately the record is absent to some degree. He didn't say I'm ignoring those. He didn't say I'm including those. Certainly, I think the better record would have been for him to say, in addition to the reasons I stated earlier, I'm also denying the durational down for these reasons. And the record is absent with respect to that. But ultimately, what he explicitly said is, here's why I'm denying the durational departure. And in my mind, that essentially is an abuse of discretion because he's relying on an element of the offense as a reason for that denial.
Thank you. You will have 15, you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal time. You might like 15 minutes of rebuttal time. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Natalie Schifferl, and I represent the state of Minnesota in this appeal. I'd like to start out by just indicating that the district court did not abuse its discretion when it denied appellant's motion for either a dispositional or durational departure or both. Rather, it carefully considered all of the available information that was before making this decision. So this is not a rare case where the appellate court should interfere with the sentencing court's decision, as the appellant in this case was sentenced within the sentencing guidelines.
Why wouldn't we, in the interest of, even if we think the district court would reach the same conclusion, given the district court's stated basis for rejecting the durational departure, and we'd have to infer that the district court meant to incorporate something else into its analysis in order to affirm, wouldn't we? And if that's the case, why wouldn't we, just in the interest of due process, just to make sure that district courts are aware of the how the analysis is supposed to occur for the ease of appellate review, why wouldn't we send it back to the district court to say what we might all think the district court would say, which is that the multiple occurrences is enough to treat this as not significantly different or less serious than the typical case?
Well, Your Honor, there's two reasons. And the first is, as Attorney Holton indicated, you should take Judge Jesse at his word. Judge Jesse, in the sentencing transcript that you guys have, went through a commingled analysis as to offender and offense related, and then ended it by saying, that I don't find compelling circumstances here to grant a downward dispositional or durational departure. I cannot say in good conscience say that this crime was any less serious than usual and somebody died. But it's not the first reference he made in his analysis to the fact that somebody died and there is a price to be paid for that. He referenced it earlier in the fact, or in his analysis, when he said that there are too many cases like this. You look around at all people in this room and everybody's been affected. He references that, again, that this was a series of events that led to his death, and that there's a reason that the federal government regulates chemicals, and it's to prevent deaths like this. So he's using this death.
Can I ask you a question? I'm sorry to interrupt. I just wanted to ask you if the transcript doesn't read, as you were pointing out, it doesn't read exactly in the way that might best fit the appellant's argument, because just before somebody died, that comment is made. The district court says, I don't find compelling circumstances here to grant a downward dispositional or a durational departure, right? So it's as you say, everything's linked together. But if it were that the district court simply said, I'm going to deny the motion for downward durational departure for this reason. Somebody died, period. Would that have been an abuse of discretion? Because as your counterpart points out, in every manslaughter case, someone has died. And so the court really hasn't made any decision that this was actually less serious than usual, because that is the typical case.
No, Your Honor, the state would still not, or the judge still would not have abused his discretion. In State versus Olson, which I cited in my brief, but it's 765 Northwest 2nd, 662, and I'm quoting directly from this, they indicate that appellant has cited no authority to indicate that doing so, so improperly relying on the elements to deny a departure motion would have been improper. But then it goes on to say, regardless, we disagree that the district court improperly relied on the elements of the offense to deny a departure. This shows that you can use those elements to deny a departure to show that it's not significantly less serious. Further, even where there might be some substantial and compelling reasons for a departure, a sentencing court is not required to depart. And they're not required to even explain its reasonings for imposing the presumptive sentence under State versus Ruhler, which is 378 Northwest 2nd,
right, 77. I think Mr. Holson's argument, though, is that what we do on review is we attempt to verify that the district court, in fact, exercised its discretion. And if the district court didn't exercise its discretion, and it's clear to us that the district court didn't, if that were the case, then we wouldn't then go and look at the record and say, well, if the district court had exercised its discretion, there would have been enough here to deny the departure request. I think that's a correct way to look at it from a legal standpoint. You can correct me if I'm wrong about that.
No, I do understand. And the court does need to look at whether the discretion was even used, but I think that's clear in the record here, both in looking at the fact that somebody died and at the fact, as the judge explained and as my brief lays out, there were multiple sales, and that was part of the reasoning here. It goes towards the offense related factor, and it was used both in the dispositional and durational departure analysis by the judge. He didn't specifically say, I'm looking at dispositional here and I'm looking at durational here. He did intermingle those, which I will admit does make it a little bit trickier on appeal, but I think it's still laid out pretty clearly here. Both were considered.
But you would agree. Oh, go ahead. Sorry. Oh, go ahead.
I'm concerned about the dispositional departure with some of the reasonings that the judge used. The judge seemed to hold it against the appellant that she posted unconditional bail, which is her constitutional right to do so. In fact, the judge said, by the choice of posting unconditional bail, you're telling me you'd rather pay the unconditional bail than follow the conditions followed by the court. And then later said she chose not to follow the conditions by using non-prescribed mood-altering chemicals and alcohol. Why is that not a problem? It doesn't seem to be a proper consideration.
It is part of, I think, showing the appellant's actions during the course of the case and her reaction and consideration to court and showing her cooperation and attitude. So I don't believe that the sentencing judge here said this is, first of all, he didn't say this is the only reason I'm denying your departure, but he did take that into consideration in her attitude while in court. She had that
constitutional right to post unconditional bail. I mean, there's conditions and unconditioned, you know, conditions and unconditional, and she chose unconditional. I don't know why that should be held against her.
And I don't believe that it explicitly that she just posted unconditional was held against her. I think he used that as a segue into her actions during the pendency of the case, where this is a case where it involved drug sales and drug use, and she decided actively, as she told the PSI writer, to use marijuana and to continue using substances during the pendency while also claiming she didn't have a problem. So I don't think it's exclusively looking at that she posted unconditional, but at her actions during the court proceeding.
It wasn't illegal for her to use alcohol to drink, right?
It was not illegal for her to use alcohol, but it was to use marijuana, Your Honor.
Right. At the time,
At the time.
yep, it was illegal at the time. But the court also cited to drinking and using alcohol at the time. But she had no conditions. So how is that proper?
She had no conditions, but it does show her attitude toward the court and towards part of what the appellant's attorney at the time was trying to argue, was that she was particularly amenable to probation, and showing that given the severity and the circumstances of this case, her continuing to use substances but still indicate that she had no substance use problem was what the court was, I think, trying to get at.
Would it be appropriate for a court to say, you're still smoking cigarettes, and therefore that shows that you have addiction issues?
I think if that was one of the things that defense was arguing wasn't going to be a problem, then it would be. And here they were specifically indicating that her chemical use and alcohol use is not problematic, but she continued to use very consistently. So that's where I think that was coming from. If a defendant was trying to make the argument, oh, I don't have a cigarette problem, but was smoking a pack a day, I think that would be appropriate to consider. As far as the dispositional departure, in addition to that factor, the appellant is not particularly amenable to probation, and the court looked at the other TROG factors as well, including specifically, I wanted to highlight the remorse. And I would just like to point out that the sentencing court, having sat at all stages of this case, the district court was in and is in the most appropriate position to judge the authenticity of the remorse here. And I think it's very clear that the court found that the appellant's expressed written and verbal remorse was not authentic based on her actions during the investigation and during the pendency of the case. So Judge Jesse was looking at the multiple sales, but also looking at the fact that the appellant participated in the celebration of life for the victim in this case, despite knowing that she had given the pills that killed the victim in this case. So there were multiple areas, and including in the pre-sentence investigation, where the appellant noted specifically that it was back to noting, despite having pled and provided a factual basis, was it once again denying that she provided the specific pills that killed the victim in this case. So I think that there is a clear demonstration of the fact that the appellant was not remorseful. So I do think that there were sufficient statements on the record by the judge and in the record by the parties to show that the TROG factors did not overwhelmingly lead to a decision that the court would have abused its discretion here.
Would standard conditions of probation have included prohibition on using controlled substances? And would it include a prohibition on using alcohol?
That is, I believe, what one of the recommendations in the PSI, if the court chose to depart. And I know that's something that the state would have requested. But without having gone through and being sentenced to probation, I can't guarantee that. I know one of the conditions would have been a chemical use assessment, which if the defendant went in saying, I don't have a problem, I don't have a problem, and there's no proof that she's using outside of the fact that she told the PSI writer that she was using, but still saying she didn't have a problem, that there probably wouldn't have been any sort of consequence or recommendations based on that.
Did the PSI support that there was a connection between her own use of chemicals and the offense?
I don't believe that was directly linked in the PSI. I do know that that would be a typical recommendation with circumstances here where this case was originally charged as a murder three for the sale of the fentanyl that led to the victim's death here. So that would be typical as a condition, but I don't know that it was specifically linked. I would note that in the text messages, specifically about the pills that went on to cause Mr. Wegman's death, she did say, do you want to go in on these with me? showing that she at one point had at least planned on keeping some of those pills to use herself. So there is a connection that's been shown throughout this case, but I don't know that the PSI specifically made that connection. The other thing I wanted to point out, as the court is very well aware, a reviewing court may not interfere with a sentencing court's exercise of discretion as long as it shows that the court did carefully evaluate the testimony and information presented, and I think that is clear here. I would also note that even if grounds for a departure exist, be it dispositional or durational, a sentence within the presumptive guidelines range is presumed to be appropriate and should not ordinarily be disturbed.
Can I ask you just to go back to where we started and Judge Ross's question? And I know these aren't our facts, but I'm just curious as to your view of the limits of Olson. If the district court judge had said, I find that this case is not, or this offense is not serious, less serious than the typical offense because a person died, would you agree? And then that's all the court said in denying the downward durational departure motion. Would you agree that that would indicate what Judge Ross alluded to as a failure to exercise any discretion? Because what the district court did was describe every manslaughter case in which someone dies, and then said it's not less serious than other manslaughter cases. Would you agree with that, or do you think that Olson would rebut that as well?
I think that Olson does rebut that as well. It very explicitly says that relying on elements of the offense is not inappropriate. Based on the fact that the district court did not abuse its discretion in denying the appellant's departure motion and imposing the presumptive guideline sentence, I would ask the court to affirm this case. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant, rebuttal.
So I want to address two issues. The first one I think is addressed fairly easily, and that's opposing counsel's reference to State v. Olson. In State v. Olson, the appellate court specifically addressed reasons that were used by the trial court for denying the downward dispositional departure that were not specific elements of the offense. So the appellate court specifically addressed both the length of the attack and the number of victims, which are not elements of the offense of aiding and abetting harassment with a firearm, and said based on those differences, it was proper for the trial court to deny the departure. Secondly, I want to address the issue that you raised, Judge Schmidt, which is the posting of the unconditional bond in this matter. The court essentially draws every single negative inference possible from the decision to post unconditional bond, which is a constitutional right for somebody that is presumed innocent, without really any sort of basis for drawing that conclusion. So essentially, the trial court concludes that the reason that the unconditional bond was posted was so that appellant could consume alcohol, drink, and I think as a matter of fact, it's not fair to necessarily draw that conclusion. So for example,
you did admit to using marijuana during that time, right?
I'm sorry, say that again, Cal, Your Honor?
She did admit to using marijuana during that time, correct?
She did.
And it was still illegal at the time she was using it in the state of Minnesota, right?
I don't disagree with what you're asking. I think the question is, was the decision to post the unconditional bail driven by her desire to continue using marijuana, which is what the conclusion that the court drew, which I don't think you can necessarily draw that conclusion.
But is it an abuse of discretion? I mean, we're looking at it on review. If the district court came to that conclusion or had that belief for reasons that are maybe in the record, but not apparent to us, just observation and understanding the parties and getting all of the data. You know, even if it is a constitutional right to have to post unconditional bond, why would that be a concern for us for reversal purpose?
Well, I think it's a concern anytime you rely on or use a constitutional right as a basis for denying a departure.
But in
for
this
example,
context,
if it,
but in this context, where assuming that the district court is looking at the defendant and saying and believing for whatever reason that the rationale to exercise this right is to do something illegal. Your goal was to act illegally and continue to use marijuana. And there's no constitutional right to use marijuana. I'm trying to get a sense of why, even if we might have some concerns about the district court's reference to a constitutional right, why that would be a basis for us to reverse.
So I think, in my mind, I think that the issue is drawing the conclusion that that was the underlying reason for her posting the unconditional bid. So you're essentially drawing the negative inference, and at least from my perspective, the record is bereft of reasons to draw that negative inference. I don't disagree that at the time this all was going on, that marijuana was illegal when she was using.
What would be our standard of review of that concern? I mean, is there some law that says, or is there some precedent we should rely upon to say the district court is not allowed to draw a negative inference without something expressly stated in the record establishing why? For the purposes,
Your Honor, I don't know that there's any explicit case law that indicates that. It seems to me the better practice would have been for the court to ask appellant, you posted unconditional bail, why did you do that? I realize this is not part of the record, but my understanding is that she had to travel for work, and one of the restrictions with the conditional bail was she couldn't leave the state of Minnesota. So, you know, that's where you get into drawing that negative inference without a basis for doing so, when there may have been very good reasons for posting the unconditional bail that had absolutely nothing to do with continuing to use chemicals, either legal in the case of alcohol or illegal in the case of marijuana.
Well, your time has expired, but I want to make sure if anyone else on the panel has a further question, we can explore it with Mr. Olson. Okay, none. Well, thank you both for your briefing in this matter and for your participation in the oral argument this morning. The matter is submitted. We will issue our opinion within the statutory period. So thank you very much and have a wonderful day.
Thank you.
Thank you.